Frodo woke and found himself lying in bed. At first, he thought that he had slept late, after a long, unpleasant dream that still hovered on the edge of memory. Or perhaps he had been ill, but the ceiling looked strange. It was flat, and it had dark beams richly carved. He lay a little while longer, looking at patches of sunlight on the wall, and listening to the sound of a waterfall. "Where am I, and what is the time?" he said aloud to the ceiling. "In the house of Elrond, and it is 10 o'clock in the morning," said a voice. "It is the morning of October the 24th, if you want to know." "Gandalf!" cried Frodo, sitting up. There was the old wizard, sitting in a chair by the open window. "Yes," he said, "I am here, and you are lucky to be here too, after all the absurd things you have done since you left home."
Okay, how does Frodo know what a waterfall sounds like? Okay, Clifford, back again.
Yes, we are. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How about you?
Doing well.
I really enjoyed this chapter. I love this chapter. In my power ranking so far, I might put it at number one at this point.
Wow. That's a big one.
Because I really loved the Gilder chapter, and I loved the House of Tom Bombadil, and the Flight to the Ford was pretty good too.
This falls in our pattern that we've talked about before of Tolkien alternating between super intense action chapter and then super intense dialogue chapter when no action happens.
Yeah, but this one, surprisingly, we cover a lot of ground, you know?
We do.
Like there's a ton of, I don't know, exposition. But then, like, you're totally right that I think this is the crown jewel of the rest chapters because this one's all about the mood. Like, the mood of this one is just so awesome. I love it. And because, you know, it's all about just, like, the feeling that you get, we're going to have to read a lot of excerpts from this one.
In case we forgot to say so at the beginning, this is Fellowship of the Ring, Book 2, Chapter 1, Many Meetings.
Yeah. All right, so today we got to talk about, obviously, Frodo and Gandalf's conversation when he wakes up, which we already heard the start of. We'll talk about that feast. Again, crown jewel of feast of all that we've had so far. We got to talk about the reunion with the special someone. And we got to talk about this Hall of Fire, which is possibly my favorite room of all time. And then we actually got to go through a bunch of the draft stuff because Tolkien, as he was writing this is like a pretty pivotal time. So I'm going to fly through some notes of that at the end for those interested. All right, but before that, back to Cliff's notes. Let's go.
So, as stated, not that much goes down in this chapter besides dialogue. But Frodo wakes up in a strange room and discovers Gandalf by his side. He's overjoyed but confused. They talk, and Frodo learns what happened since the flight to the Ford and how the healing powers of Elrond have saved him. They sit now in Rivendell, the last homely home, House of Elrond. When Frodo is ready, he rejoins Sam and the other hobbits, who are all okay, and they join a grand feast with the elves of Rivendell. Frodo is overwhelmed by the importance of the guests around him. He gets to meet Gloin, one of the dwarves Bilbo journeyed with years ago. At the end of the feast, it is revealed that Bilbo himself is sitting in the corner, and Frodo is thrilled. They talk at length, and then Bilbo sings one of the songs that he's been working on in his old age. The elves are quite impressed with the song, and eventually the hobbits head to bed.
All right, cool. Let's jump in then, because we don't want to waste time. Okay, toss up. You want Frodo or you want Gandalf?
I'll take Gandalf.
Oh, okay, fine. You got to put on your old man voice, though.
Okay.
That's not good. It sounds like a trucker. Okay. All right. So Frodo wakes up, as we read at the beginning, and he's immediately, obviously, saw Gandalf there. And so his first question is like, well, where's Sam and the others? And then obviously he's like, well, what happened at the Ford?
Well, Gandalf says, "You are beginning to fade. The wound was overcoming you at last. A few more hours and you would have been beyond our aid. But you have some strength in you, my dear hobbit, as you showed in the barrow. That was touch and go, perhaps the most dangerous moment of all. I wish I could have held out at Weathertop. But nice job getting here. Impressive journey."
Right, and so Frodo says, well, we couldn't have done it without Strider. But, you know, Frodo of course asks, but where were you? We needed your help. We were expecting you the whole time.
To which Gandalf says, not letting on too much, I was delayed. I'll fill you in later, but you have to rest and not worry too much right now. We're going to have a council all together once you're better, and that's when we'll talk about everything. But I will give you a hint and say that I was captured.
You captured? What? Gandalf? What?
Yes, I, Gandalf the Grey. There are many powers in the world, for good or for evil. Some are greater than I am. Against some, I have not yet been measured, but my time is coming. The Morgul Lord and his Black Riders have come forth. War is preparing.
And so Frodo's like, well, wait, so you knew about the Riders this whole time?
Yeah, and Gandalf says that he actually has already told Frodo about them. They're the 9 Ringwraiths of the Lord of the Rings. But we'll talk about that later as well. Strider did save the day.
Yeah, and then Frodo says, I'm glad, for I've become very fond of Strider. Well, fond is not the right word. I mean, he is dear to me, though he is strange and grim at times. In fact, he reminds me often of you. I didn't know that any of the big people were like that. I thought, well, they were just big and rather stupid. Kind and stupid like Butterburn, or stupid and wicked like Bill Fearney. But then we don't know much about men in the Shire, except perhaps the Brelanders.
You don't know much even about them, if you think old Barley Man is stupid, said Gandalf. He is wise enough on his own ground. He thinks less than he talks, and slower. Yet he can see through a brick wall in time, as they say in Bree. But there are few left in Middle-earth like Aragorn, son of Arathorn. The race of the kings from over the sea is nearly at an end. It may be that this War of the Ring will be their last adventure.
Do you really mean that Strider is one of the people of the old kings? Said Frodo in wonder. I thought they had all vanished long ago. I thought he was only a ranger.
Only a ranger, cried Gandalf. My dear Frodo, that is just what the rangers are. The last remnant in the north of the great people, the men of the west. They have helped me before, and I shall need their help in the days to come. For we have reached Rivendell, and the ring is not yet at rest.
I suppose not, said Frodo, but so far my only thought has been to get here, and I hope I shan't have to go any further. It is very pleasant just to rest. I've had a month of exile and adventure, and I find that has been as much as I want. Should we stop here and discuss a little bit? Because this is kind of big. We just heard a bunch of stuff about Strider.
Mm-hmm.
Descendant of kings.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty crazy.
This is the most we've heard about him so far.
Right, and Gandalf's calling him Aragorn.
We already know that name, though, right? He introduced himself as Aragorn.
Yeah, but we've been using Strider, but now it's just going to transition that it's going to be Aragorn mostly. So just get ready for that if you're reading along.
Okay.
But yeah, so these rangers are already friends with Gandalf and everything, and so, I don't know, interesting though that Frodo wasn't really picking up on this, and even like just his thoughts of men in general were weird, or I don't know, naive, I guess.
It's a little bit of a throwback to, I think, the very beginning of The Hobbit. In the introduction to The Hobbit, where he's talking about what are hobbits and how do they differ from men, the big people. And there's kind of the implication that hobbits are small and quiet and crafty and men are big and stupid. And so this is like a throwback to that based on the Shire mythology that Frodo was raised on.
Yeah.
But also Gandalf is maybe correcting Frodo to bring it full circle into the more complicated narrative we've got going on in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And then like a ton of foreshadowing with it too, like, okay, these guys are going to be important, all these rangers and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Also notable here was Frodo's last paragraph there. He says, I hope I shan't have to go any further. He's hoping this is it and then he's done.
Yeah
He's like, I did this for a month, but I think this is as much as I want.
Yeah, have I finished my quest? And it is a moment of, I don't know, Frodo definitely seems more childish and helpless here. Obviously he's like incapacitated in bed.
Yeah.
But this is the first we're hearing of what Gandalf's been up to outside the world of the Shire, kind of his affairs, and he's alluding to all these things that are going on, people that he knows, information that he had, forces at work above the head that's going on really without Frodo's knowledge. So from Frodo's standpoint, he's kind of like, okay, I'm done. I did it. And right. Now it's time for the adults to take over.
Yeah, which, I don't know. I think that's a fair idea at this point. Because they were clearly all in over their head for the entire first book. Like, they needed help at every turn, you know?
Right.
So, I think that's kind of an understandable position for Frodo to want to take. Anyways, though, it goes on here. So, Frodo says his wound is no longer cold. He doesn't really feel anything, but he can move his arm a bit. Gandalf told him that Elrond cured him, and he tended him for 4 days.
4 nights and 3 days, to be exact. The elves brought you from the ford on the night of the 20th, and that is where you lost count. We have been terribly anxious, and Sam has hardly left your side, day or night, except to run messages. Elrond is a master of healing, but the weapons of our enemy are deadly. To tell you the truth, I had very little hope, for I suspected that there was some fragment of the blade still in the closed wound. But it could not be found until last night. Then Elrond removed the splinter. It was deeply buried, and it was working inwards.
Remember when Aragorn found the knife at Weathertop, it was notched at the top?
Mm-hmm.
So we were right that there was a splinter of it still somewhere in the wound.
It sounds like it was almost like animated, like it was moving through some will of its own towards Frodo's heart. So Frodo and Gandalf go on discussing exactly what happened, and Frodo wants to know more about the Black Riders. Gandalf begins to explain who they are, but Frodo's a little bit confused how he was able to see them and their horses and their cloaks if they're really just ghosts, wraiths. "Yes, fortune or fate have helped you," said Gandalf, "not to mention courage, for your heart was not touched, and only your shoulder was pierced, and that was because you resisted to the last. But it was a terribly narrow shave, so to speak. You were in the gravest peril while you wore the ring, for then you were half in the Wraith world yourself, and they might have seized you. You could see them, and they could see you."
"I know," said Frodo, "they were terrible to behold, but why could we all see their horses?"
Gandalf explains, because they are real horses, they're real robes, and plenty of things serve the Dark Lord, not just wraiths. Horses, orcs, trolls, wargs, werewolves, men, including many warriors and kings that walk alive.
Right, and so then Frodo's asking, well, is Rivendell going to be safe?
"Yes, at present, until all else is conquered, the elves may fear the Dark Lord, and they may fly before him, but never again will they listen to him or serve him. And here, in Rivendell, there live some of his chief foes, the Elvenwise, lords of the Eldar, from beyond the furthest seas. They do not fear the Ringwraiths, for those who have dwelt in the Blessed Realm live at once in both worlds, and against both the seen and the unseen they have great power."
The never listen to him again is kind of interesting. I think that goes to the creation of the rings. So we'll probably talk about that in the next chapter.
Okay.
But then also,
maybe an implication that at some point in the history, elves did fall under the sway of the Dark Lord.
Or there was some collaborating.
Okay.
Possibly. We'll see.
We'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. And then chiefest foes from beyond the sea. So these are people like Glorfindel. That guy was literally sent back. There's a healthy population that they were with the original Noldor, who came all the way with Fëanor and the Silmarillion to go take back the Silmarils, and then they never left.
From Valinor to Middle-earth.
Right, yeah.
So they're basically, they're the OG elves.
Right, yeah. It's interesting what they're saying. They live in both worlds at once.
Yeah, I remember we talked a little bit about Glorfindel at Flight to the Ford, how he was kind of like the closest thing we could get to an angel
right.
for the elves. Like he had died and been brought back or something.
Yeah, because we get into it right here. It sounds like Glorfindel was, when Frodo was falling into the shadow world, you know, as he was riding away on the horse, and mm-hmm. he could clearly see the riders, and the riders could clearly see him in like that shadow world.
Mm-hmm.
I think Glorfindel was also there pretty clearly in like that angelic form, you know, and Glorfindel knew and could see that too.
Okay.
Which is basically what Frodo's saying here, because he's like, so the white figure I saw that did not grow dim, that was Glorfindel then?
"Yes, you saw him for a moment as he is upon the other side, one of the mighty of the firstborn. He is an elf lord of a house of princes. Indeed, there is a power in Rivendell to withstand the might of Mordor for a while, and elsewhere other powers still dwell. There is power, too, of another kind in the Shire. But all such places will soon become islands under siege if things go on as they are going. The Dark Lord is putting forth all his strength. But you're in Rivendell now, so you don't need to worry about anything for the moment."
And so Frodo just says, all right, I can do that. I can rest and be content if you just tell me just fully what happened at the ford, and then I'll be all good for now.
Gandalf moved his chair to the bedside and took a good look at Frodo. The color had come back to his face, and his eyes were clear and fully awake and aware. He was smiling, and there seemed to be little wrong with him. But to the wizard's eye there was a faint change, just a hint, as it were, of transparency about him, and especially about the left hand that lay outside the coverlet. "Still, that must be expected," said Gandalf to himself. "He is not half through yet, and to what he will come in the end, not even Elrond can foretell. Not to evil, I think. He may become like a glass filled with a clear light for eyes to see that can."
So those are interesting notes that Gandalf's saying to himself there. But yeah, you want to go on, because just to finish off the story here?
"You look splendid," he said aloud. "I will risk a brief tale without consulting Elrond. But quite brief, mind you, and then you must sleep again. For this is what happened, as far as I can gather. The riders made straight for you as soon as you fled. They did not need the guidance of their horses any longer. You had become visible to them, being already on the threshold of their world. And also the ring drew them. Your friends sprang aside, off the road, or they would have been ridden down. They knew that nothing could save you if the white horse could not. The riders were too swift to overtake, and too many to oppose. On foot, even Glorfindel and Aragorn together could not withstand all the nine at once. When the ringwraith swept by, your friends ran up close behind. Close to the ford there was a small hollow beside the road, masked by a few stunted trees. There they hastily kindled fire, for Glorfindel knew that a flood would come down if the riders tried to cross, and then he would have to deal with any that were left on his side of the river. The moment the flood appeared, he rushed out, followed by Aragorn and the others with flaming brands. Caught between fire and water, and seeing an elf lord revealed in his wrath, they were dismayed, and their horses were stricken with madness. Three were carried away by the first assault of the flood. The others were now hurled into the water by their horses and overwhelmed."
And then Frodo's asking, well, so are the Black Riders done then? Is that the end of them?
"No, their horses are dead, but you can't kill them that easily. You don't need to worry about them right now. Shortly thereafter, though, your friends found you lying on your face, pale and cold, and Elrond's folks came to carry you away."
So, who sent the flood?
Elrond himself.
Okay, so that's kind of important, too. But Elrond what?
"The river of this valley is under his power and will rise in anger to protect the ford."
Oh, come on, add that detail.
By the way, did you see the horses in the waves? That was my addition.
Yeah, so then at that point, Gandalf just ends it with, you know, now it's time for feasting and merrymaking because we're going to celebrate the victory at the Ford of Bruin. So yeah, so, you know, we had a big discussion at the end of the last chapter about what's the deal with the flood, because he was invoking, like, the name of Elbereth and everything, and so it's like, but, like, where's this coming from? Like, it's not, did she summon it, or was it, like, a power or something? But it's like, okay, so it sounds like it's Elrond with touches of Gandalf, you know, and they're working together, and so, like, so, yeah, I mean, that's cleared up now.
And that's, it fits in as a tangible detail of what we've just gotten in more abstract form, that Rivendell is safe, there's a lot of good power here. The elves are strong. The elves are uncorruptible. I feel like we've been introduced now to the rebel stronghold, and they're not too worried, but the key thing is that they can only hold out for so long.
And, you know, storm clouds are gathering. Like, war is coming.
They're like islands in a storm.
Yeah. And well, I don't know if they're quite islands yet. I feel like it's just like everything, they're about to be islands.
Right. And there was a little allusion there to the Shire. Let me find the line. "There is power, too, of another kind in the Shire." And we get no other explanation there, but whatever's going on there, something's protecting the Shire as well as Rivendell. It lets them be these, from the descriptions, kind of like little glimpses of paradise in a world that's becoming darker and more evil.
Should we move on?
Yes. Speaking of the last homely house east of the sea.
Right. So it's just as Bilbo had reported from The Hobbit, a perfect house, whether you like food or sleep or storytelling or singing or just sitting and thinking best, or a pleasant mixture of them all. Merely to be there was a cure for weariness, fear, and sadness. So, same old, I guess, mm-hmm. at Rivendell. Like, because, I mean, we remember that from The Hobbit, which is nice. Okay, so a couple, like, minor things. Like, it was, I like the part where Frodo looks in the mirror and he sees a thinner self. And it looked remarkably like a young nephew of Bilbo who used to go tramping with his uncle in the Shire. But the eyes looked out at him thoughtfully. Yes, you have seen a thing or two since you last peeped into a looking glass.
So, Frodo runs into Sam, who's super, super excited to see him. And Sam right. notes that Frodo's hand is no longer cold.
And then there's nice descriptions about walking through the garden, and then they meet Pippin and Merry with Gandalf again down there.
Make way for Frodo, Lord of the Ring.
Hush, said Gandalf from the shadows of the back porch. Evil things do not come into this valley, but all the same, we should not name them. The Lord of the Ring is not Frodo, but the master of the Dark Tower of Mordor, whose power is again stretching out over the world. We are sitting in a fortress outside. It is getting dark.
Gandalf has been saying many cheerful things like that, said Pippin. He thinks I need keeping in order. But it seems impossible somehow to feel gloomy or depressed in this place. I feel I could sing if I knew the right song for the occasion.
So personally, this whole chapter makes me feel like it's like Christmas Day. You know, I don't quite know why, but it always puts me in a good mood. Like all your friends and family are there, and they're all celebrating, and everybody's happy. You know, and then it's like they're probably all in like these fancy costumes, and it's like fall decorated and everything. You know, and so it's like yeah, somehow it just reminds me of Christmas time whenever I read this.
I was going to say it is like a Christmas feast, except we've got basically all of the most important people in Middle Earth happen to be at the feast.
Exactly. Well, that's why it's like everybody's here, you know, this is what's awesome. Again, like we were saying before, this is like the king of all the feasts that we've had. What are all the ones that we've had so far? Can you name them?
Let's see. We had the feast at the beginning, very beginning of the story, Bilbo's birthday party, when Bilbo disappears.
Yeah.
We had, let's see, Frodo, Merry, Pippin, and Sam being treated to dinner at Farmer Maggot's house.
Okay.
We had the feasting with Tom Bombadil.
Yeah.
And that's all I can think of in The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, come on.
What?
Well, there's Crick Hollow. They had, like, the bath scene, and then they had a big feast there.
Oh, right, right, right.
That okay. was literally the same night as Farmer Maggot.
Right. That was a double feast.
Yeah. And then
that was more of a late-night snack.
Well, they partied out at Prancing Pony, too.
Okay, you know? And yeah, and then there's the Prancing Pony when Frodo yeah. accidentally put the ring on.
Okay, let's see. So they're seeing a bunch of elves and all these important guests and everything. They see Elrond, Glorfindel, and Gandalf at the head of the table. Frodo looked at them in wonder, for he had never before seen Elrond, of whom so many tales spoke. And as they sat upon his right hand and left hand, Glorfindel and even Gandalf, whom he had thought he knew so well, were revealed as lords of dignity and power. So there's, like, a cool description for each of them. Should we read those, or should we just keep going? It's up to you. I don't think we're doing terrible on time, so.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay.
Gandalf was shorter in stature than the other two, but his long white hair, his sweeping silver beard, and his broad shoulders made him look like some wise king of ancient legend. In his aged face, under great snowy brows, his dark eyes were set like coals that could leap suddenly into fire.
Okay, so that's Gandalf. We're going to compare these, so pick which one you think is best. Here's Glorfindel. Glorfindel was tall and straight. His hair was of shining gold, his face fair and young and fearless and full of joy. His eyes were bright and keen, and his voice like music. On his brow sat wisdom, and in his hand was strength.
The face of Elrond was ageless, neither old nor young. Though in it was written the memory of many things, both glad and sorrowful. His hair was dark as the shadows of twilight, and upon it was set a circlet of silver. His eyes were gray as a clear evening, and in them was a light like the light of stars. Venerable he seemed as a king crowned with many winters, and yet hale as a tried warrior in the fullness of his strength. He was the Lord of Rivendell, and mighty among both elves and men.
I think Elrond wins.
Yeah. this little segment reminds me of maybe old mythology, in particular some like Norse mythology, where before a feast or a battle or something like that, there's like a tally. I don't know if there's a proper term for this, but they'll take a big segment of the text to just say who is present in a situation.
I don't think this is epic enough. I know exactly what you're talking about, and there's gonna be one of those in Lord of the Rings.
Okay, but... okay. We'll talk about that in a more battle context, but I think this is I would consider this like a soft reference to that tradition of, okay, like, and then we've got this guy and he's great for these reasons, and then we got this guy who's great for these reasons. And I always find, what I find humorous is, like, everyone's description is like they're the best in certain ways, and these, Tolkien is, I think, bridging between that tradition and, like, a more modern, flushed out character breakdown, where he's using, like, much more floral descriptive language for each of these people, which is kind of cool to see.
Right. Now, there was one other, there's a couple other important characters, but there's another elf that's also important, and we have to read this description, mm-hmm. So I'll just go for it here. In the middle of the table, against the woven cloths upon the wall, there was a chair under a canopy, and there sat a lady fair to look upon. And so like was she in form of womanhood to Elrond, that Frodo guessed that she was one of his close kindred. Young she was, and yet not so. The braids of her dark hair were touched by no frost. Her white arms and clear face were flawless and smooth, and the light of stars was in her bright eyes, gray as cloudless night. Yet queenly she looked, and thought and knowledge were in her glance, as of one who has known many things that the years bring. Above her brow, her head was covered with a cap of silver lace, netted with small gems, glittering white, but her soft gray raiment had no ornament, save a girdle of leaves wrought in silver. So it was that Frodo saw her whom few mortals had seen, Arwen, daughter of Elrond, in whom it is said that the likeness of Lúthien had come on the world again, and she was called Undamiel, for she was the even star of her people. Long she had been in the land of her mother's kin, in Lórien, beyond the mountains, but was lately returned to Rivendell, to her father's house. But her brothers Eladan and Elrohir were out upon an errantry, for they rode often far afield with the rangers of the north, forgetting never their mother's torment in the den of the orcs.
So that was a mouthful right there, but...
Yeah, and that was an introduction.
So,
for somebody that we don't actually talk to.
Arwen, daughter of Elrond, whose description is effectively the female version of Elrond's description. Some of the phrases are even just, like, paraphrased versions of the same thing.
And she's the closest thing to Lúthien.
Yes, who we talked about very recently.
Oh yeah, we did. Oh yeah.
And once again, in the tradition of epic stories, you can get bogged down sometimes in the number of descriptions of, like, people who are the strongest or the most beautiful. But Lúthien is supposed to be the most beautiful of all the elves, right?
Yeah, takes the cake.
Right. And Arwen is the likeness of Lúthien.
And then also, it was interesting, they mentioned the mother's torment. So she's got two brothers, and then the mother was tormented by orcs. So Elrond's wife is no longer here because she didn't actually die, but once she was tormented by orcs, then she left Middle-earth for Valinor to, like, rest in kind of peace, you know, in bliss.
Okay, do we know anything about said torment, or we have to wait and see?
We're not really going to find anything out. It's just, like, they were crossing over the Misty Mountains, and there were still some orc holds there or something. Actually, this was before The Hobbit, I assume. Yeah, it must have been way before The Hobbit. So, yeah, Misty Mountains were always filled with orcs, so it happened at some point there. But I think the Sons or Elrond just barely saved her before she was killed, and then she still couldn't, like, she needed, like, to be in the Blessed Realm, basically.
Okay, okay.
We'll hear other backstories of this family at some point, but I don't know if we'll cover the mom again, so good thing we just mentioned it here.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, Frodo's sitting at this table, and he's with all these noble folk. He feels small, typical hobbit, you know, insecurity. He sees the other three hobbits at the side table, you know, like the kids' table at Christmas is another one.
Right.
I have this feeling. No sign of Strider anywhere, and then he's sitting next to this well-dressed dwarf.
The dwarf says, "Welcome and well met. Gloin at your service."
And then Frodo, he greets him too, but he's just like, am I right in guessing that you're the Gloin? One of the 12 companions of the Great Thorn Oakenshield? Which is actually, like, that is fun, like, when this comes up, because it's like, again, I said this at the Trolls, but these parts, the parts where the references the Hobbit, it's just like all the history things that they're referencing, but these ones we actually get. I mean, we're explaining the Silmarillion ones as they come,
mm-hmm.
but the Hobbit ones we've all interacted with personally. We know that through and through.
Right.
You know, and so it's fun when these come up.
And it feels a little bit like, you know, Tolkien would have thrown this stuff in there because his audience knew the Hobbit, loved the Hobbit, wanted more. And he's launched this crazy, dark, complex, not quite sequel, but he still has to kind of pay homage to the fans, you know?
Right.
Gloin responds, "I've heard you're Bilbo's heir. Congratulations on recovering. I've heard you've been on a strange adventure. Strange things are afoot these days."
Right. Well, and so Frodo basically says, it's probably not best to speak of it now, but what brings you here from the Lonely Mountain?
Also, best not to speak of it now. Elrond will have to have a meeting to talk about everything.
And that sounds like it's in the works.
And this is what we heard from Gandalf. Everybody says, no, we can't say the big story until some supposed meeting with Elrond.
I'll say this now. That's gonna deliver. It's next chapter. It's big.
Okay.
It's the chapter I most fear as I plan out these episodes. And then also have to edit these episodes. But anyways, they talk together for the rest of the meal, and they're talking about Grimbjorn, the son of Bjorn, who's now in charge of the lands between the Misty Mountains, because I guess Bjorn's dead. Of old age, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
There's great friendship between the men of Dale and the dwarves of the Lonely Mountain. At this point, it's Bard's grandson who's now king. You remember good old Bard, right?
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Mm-hmm.
Shot the dragon. Pretty sweet. And then Gloin tells of his own people.
There is much to tell, good and bad, yet it is mostly good. We have so far been fortunate, though we do not escape from the shadow of these times.
And so, again, that's another feeling of wars coming, or, you know, they're becoming like islands of good. Like right, what we were saying before. Right.
Dane is still king under the mountain. He's like 250 years old now.
Yeah.
And of the 10 dwarves that survived the Battle of Five Armies at the end of The Hobbit, 7 are still around. But Balin, Ori, and Oin are missing, and that's why Gloin is in Rivendell.
Right. That's the dark topic that Gloin kind of doesn't want to touch on. And so then they go back to talking about the mountain. And then you want to read that. We've done well.
We've done well, he said, but in metalwork we cannot rival our fathers, many of whose secrets are lost. We make good armor and keen swords, but we cannot again make mail or blade to match those that were made before the dragon came. Only in mining and building have we surpassed the old days. You should see the waterways of Dale, Frodo, and the mountains and the pools. You should see the stone-paved roads of many colors, and the halls and cavernous streets under the earth with arches carved like trees, and the terraces and towers upon the mountain sides. Then you would see that we have not been idle.
So this kind of is also like that feeling of you can't retrieve the glory days.
Mm-hmm. It's very wistful.
Right. It sounds like they kind of surpassed their fathers in what are not as important skills,
mm-hmm.
almost, you know, but like the real glorious things, they, I don't know, it's not quite a de-evolution, but it's like they can't...
They're getting back to mastering the low arts, but not the high arts.
Yeah. Like, at best, they're having a silver age and the golden, but they can't get back to the golden age.
Although, I would say the building is one of the high arts.
Well, mining, digging tunnels is a high art? Come on, Clifford. But yeah, we're also kind of seeing, too, like, all these different communities are kind of coming together again, too.
Mm-hmm.
And together, not only for fellowship, but also for mutual reinforcement in an atmosphere of encroaching menace.
Yeah.
This will come to a head in the next chapter.
Yeah, it goes without saying here. We remember from The Hobbit that dwarves and elves can get along but don't totally like each other, so it's a little bit actually out of the ordinary to see Gloin at this big important elven feast.
Right. There's actually like probably like close to no fellowship between
right
them. They're only mutual partnerships,
you know, right, right,
for projects or whatever. The other thing that we're kind of starting to get is, you know, book one of this book of Lord of the Rings, it really dwarfed The Hobbit in its depth, and then probably also even in its scale and definitely in its significance, you know, like the weight of the story.
Okay.
And then now this is only the beginning of book two, but we're already on the verge of starting to see that book two is going to dwarf book one in depth and probably scale. And it's going to increase like our understanding of like how significant and weighty this adventure really is.
Okay. Know? That's an interesting observation.
Well, we'll probably get the full weight of that in the next chapter. I'd
okay.
say.
So Frodo says, I will come and see them, if I ever can. How surprised Bilbo would have been to see all the changes in the desolation of Smaug. Gloin looked at Frodo and smiled. You were very fond of Bilbo, were you not? He asked. Yes, answered Frodo. I would rather see him than all the towers and palaces in the world.
At length, the feast came to an end. Elrond and Arwen rose and went down the hall, and the company followed them in due order. The doors were thrown open, and they went across a wide passage and through other doors, and came into a further hall. In it were no tables, but a bright fire was burning in the great hearth between the carven pillars upon either side. Frodo found himself walking with Gandalf. "This is the Hall of Fire," said the wizard. "Here you will hear many songs and tales if you can keep awake, but except on high days, it usually stands empty and quiet, and people come here who wish for peace and thought. There is always fire here all year round, but there is little other light."
I was going to say, this brings to mind, it's like a cross between a ballroom and some sort of, like, temple.
We'll address that at the end.
As Elrond entered and went towards the seat prepared for him, elvish minstrels began to make sweet music. Slowly the hall filled, and Frodo looked with delight upon the many fair faces that were gathered together. The golden firelight played upon them and shimmered in their hair. Suddenly he noticed, not far from the further end of the fire, a small dark figure seated on a stool, with his back propped against a pillar. Beside him on the ground was a drinking cup and some bread. Frodo wondered whether he was ill, if people were ever ill in Rivendell, and had been unable to come to the feast. His head seemed sunk in sleep on his breast, and a fold of his dark cloak was drawn over his face. Elrond went forward and stood beside the silent figure. "Awake, little master," he said, with a smile. Then, turning to Frodo, he beckoned to him. "Now, at last, the hour has come that you have wished for, Frodo," he said. "There is a friend that you have long missed." The dark figure raised its head and uncovered its face. "Bilbo!" cried Frodo with sudden recognition, and he sprang forward. "Hello, Frodo, my lad," said Bilbo. "So you have got here at last. I hoped you would manage it. Well, well. So all this feasting is in your honor, I hear. I hope you enjoyed yourself."
Nice. All right. Reunion of the century, right?
No kidding. Frodo hasn't seen Bilbo in, what, 33 years? Something like that?
I think it's only 17.
17? Okay. I don't know where I got 33.
He was 33 at the party.
Okay.
And now he's 50. Okay. So then it sounds like, you know, so they immediately start to catch up, but Bilbo's saying he wasn't at the feast because he's kind of too old for those and it's like too much sound. Plus he's working on this song here, which we'll see.
Okay.
Which, I don't know, that's kind of weird. Like, to think about him, like, being too old for feasts at this point. If you throw back to, like, I don't know, the one that came to mind is when they had the huge feast at Lake Town with Thorin, you know, and mm-hmm. Frodo. I mean, Bilbo's there, and he's kind of like a stick in the mud, but he's definitely, like, active and always in it, you know? Right. And then especially when you think about him in the first chapter where he's organizing this huge party for literally all of the Shire. Mm-hmm. Like, the party to end all parties. Now he's too old for this stuff. But right. So, I don't know, it's kind of interesting. But Bilbo's also telling Elrond that he wasn't asleep, he was just pondering this one line that he needs the Dunedain's help to figure out. We don't mm-hmm. know who the Dunedain is. And then Elrond says he'll be found, so that you two can finish the song and then we can hear it and judge it.
So Frodo and Bilbo take the time to catch up. Bilbo left the Shire, he went to Rivendell without trying, he just kind of ended up there, and then he went to Dale with the dwarves to visit his friends. But Balin, who was his favorite dwarf, had already left. And then Bilbo came back to Rivendell, and that was decided that that was his last journey he would ever make. So he sits now in Rivendell, he writes his book, and he makes songs, to which he says, "They sing them occasionally, just to please me, I think. For, of course, they aren't really good enough for Rivendell. And I listen, and I think. Time doesn't seem to pass here, it just is. A remarkable place altogether."
Yeah, and so then Bilbo's heard most of the news about the ring being like the center of the whole thing, and so you want to take it?
"Fancy that ring of mine causing such a disturbance. It is a pity that Gandalf did not find out more sooner. I could have brought the thing here myself long ago without so much trouble. I have thought several times of going back to Hobbiton for it, but I'm getting old and they would not let me. Gandalf and Elrond, I mean. They seemed to think that the enemy was looking high and low for me and would make mincemeat of me if he caught me tottering about in the wild. And Gandalf said, 'The ring has passed on, Bilbo. It would do no good to you or to others if you tried to meddle with it again.' Odd sort of remark, just like Gandalf. But he said he was looking after you, so I let things be. I'm frightfully glad to see you safe and sound." He paused and looked at Frodo doubtfully. "Have you got it here?" he asked in a whisper. "I can't help feeling curious, you know, after all I've heard. I should very much like just to peep at it again." "Yes, I've got it," answered Frodo, feeling a strange reluctance. "It looks just the same as it ever did." "Well, I should just like to see it for a moment," said Bilbo. When he had dressed, Frodo found that while he slept, the ring had been hung around his neck on a new chain, light but strong. Slowly he drew it out, Bilbo put out his hand, but Frodo quickly drew back the ring. To his distress and amazement, he found that he was no longer looking at Bilbo. A shadow seemed to have fallen between them, and through it he found himself eyeing a little wrinkled creature with a hungry face and bony, groping hands. He felt the desire to strike him. The music and singing round them seemed to falter, and a silence fell. Bilbo looked quickly at Frodo's face and passed his hand across his eyes. "I understand now," he said. "Put it away. I am sorry. Sorry you have come in for this burden. Sorry about everything. Don't adventures ever have an end? I suppose not. Someone else always has to carry on the story. Well, it can't be helped. I wonder if it's any good trying to finish my book. But don't let's worry about it now. Let's have some real news. Tell me all about the Shire."
All right, big deal there, big deal. Okay, he's had thoughts of wanting the ring back. Well, yeah, there's the temptation to take it again, which really puts a damper on this reunion. I mean, this is literally the person that Frodo's been looking forward to seeing the most for 17 years, and now it's like, oh, shoot. Even the best person I ever knew is, like, one step away from being the gross creature Gollum.
Right. Do you feel like here that the ring is influencing Frodo or Bilbo more, or is it both?
Both. Like, you're definitely seeing there's residual effects on Bilbo.
Yeah. Bilbo's saying, hey, you know, that old ring of mine, even though he gave it to Frodo, he's like, he kind of thinks he still has it, wants it, thinks about it, wants to see it. But then Frodo also doesn't want to let anyone touch it. He's very defensive.
Right. Now, you know, he could be defensive maybe because it's like, well, I just went through this whole adventure protecting it, you know, and this was hard fought. But then there has to be an element where it's just like he selfishly wants to protect it from anybody, period.
Right, right. And he felt the desire to strike Bilbo once he saw him in this ugly creature form.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the saddest part is kind of like Bilbo, I don't know, the way I read it, he really does feel bad as soon as he starts this. Like, as soon as he, like, is tempted by it again, you know, after he had gotten rid of it 17 years ago in the Shire, he's tempted by it here, and then all of a sudden he's like, oh, now I fully get what's going on here. Like, wow, this is, you know, I ruined this reunion here in this moment, and this is, like, such a big quest and a big deal and everything. Like, I fully grasp it right here in this instant as I almost horribly screwed up again, now it's like I'm so sorry for that. Hopefully we can just move on, which is basically, they can basically move on, but I think there was still like a couple seeds of doubt even in, for the rest of Rivendell with Bilbo and Frodo. Anyways, though, to more fun topics, this Hall of Fire itself, this is like the coolest place ever, but we gotta read about these songs that go on first, then we're gonna talk about the actual hall. Okay.
Okay.
Again, this might be like my favorite idea for a room of all time.
I buy into it. I'm curious to see, though, I want to hear more about it because I've only seen a few lines describing it.
Yeah, well, just the concept that it's like, yes, this is the tale-telling room.
Yes.
This is what I'm all about, you know? Of course, this is like more of a hall than just a room. But anyway, we'll get into that. Okay, Frodo and Sam are telling Bilbo every single detail of Shire. And, you know, Bilbo, he's like, from the felling of the least tree to the prank of the smallest hobbit child, you know, he wants to hear it all. And so Bilbo, he kind of sounds like a exiled elder statesman, you know, or something. Not that we're familiar with that, but those definitely existed in, like, ancient Greece or Italy or, you know, medieval
stuff. Right, and I mean, you can imagine just like an old grandparent wants to be filled in with every detail of whatever their grandkids or whatever world they used to live in type thing.
Yeah, or like they're at like a retirement house or something. Yeah. You know? And so then at last the Dunedain appears and Frodo looks around and it's like, oh, look, it's Strider. He's the guy. So it's like, wow, he's got like a ton of names, right? And then Bilbo's saying like, yeah, I haven't even heard Strider before. And Strider's like, well, that's my brew name, whatever. You know, and so Frodo's like, why do you call him Dunedain?
Bilbo says, the Dunedain. Come on, I thought you knew enough Elvish. Dun, Adan, Man of the West, Numenorian, and to Aragorn. Why weren't you at the feast? The Lady Arwen was there. Nudge, nudge.
Yeah, it's just Strider said, Eladan and Elrohir had just returned unlooked for, and I wanted to hear news of their tidings. And
Bilbo says, okay, well, anyways, help me polish off this song before I have to present it to the elves.
Like, he could not care less.
Right.
Like, that the sons had just come back from an important mission. Okay. And then you want to read to the song. I don't know if we're going to read the whole song here because it is really long.
Yes, long is.
But So we'll see what happens. I'll work some magic in. If we don't talk about the song, we will talk about it at some point soon, which I will announce later in this.
Frodo was left to himself for a while, for Sam had fallen asleep. He was alone and felt rather forlorn, although all about him the folk of Rivendell were gathered. But those near him were silent, intent upon the music of the voices and the instruments, and they gave no heed to anything else. Frodo began to listen. At first, the beauty of the melodies and of the interwoven words in elven tongues, even though he understood them little, held him in a spell as soon as he began to attend to them. Almost it seemed that the words took shape, and visions of far lands and bright things that he had never yet imagined opened out before him, and the firelit hall became like a golden mist above seas of foam that sighed upon the margins of the world. Then the enchantment became more and more dreamlike, until he felt that an endless river of swelling gold and silver was flowing over him, too multitudinous for its pattern to be comprehended. It became part of the throbbing air about him, and it drenched and drowned him. Swiftly he sank under its shining weight into a deep realm of sleep. There he wandered long in a dream of music that turned into running water, and then suddenly into a voice. It seemed to be the voice of Bilbo chanting verses. Faint at first, and then clearer ran the words.
Arendelle was a mariner that tarried in Arverdean. He built a boat of timber felled in Nimbrothel to journey in. Her sails he wove of silver fair, of silver were her lanterns made. Her prow was fashioned like a swan, and light upon her banners laid. In panoply of ancient kings, in chained rings he armored him. His shining shield was scored with runes to ward all wounds and harm from him. His bow was made of dragon horn, his arrows shone of ebony. Of silver was his habergeon, his scabbard of chalcedony. His sword of steel was valiant, of adamant his helmet tall. An eagle plume upon his crest, upon his breast an emerald. Beneath the moon and under star he wandered far from northern strands, bewildered on enchanted ways beyond the days of mortal lands. From gnashing of the narrow ice, where shadows lie on frozen hills, from nether heats and burning waste, he turned in haste, and roving still, on starless waters far astray, at last he came to night of naught, and passed, and never sight he saw, of shining shore nor light he sought. The winds of wrath came driving him, and blindly in the foam he fled, from west to east and errandless, unheralded he homeward sped. Their flying Elwyn came to him, and flame was in the darkness lit. More bright than light of diamond, the fire upon her carinet. The Silmaril she bound on him, and crowned him with the living light. And dauntless then, with burning brow, he turned his prow, and in the night, from other world beyond the sea, there strong and free a storm arose, a wind of power in Tarmenel. By paths that seldom mortal goes, his boat bore, with biting breath, as might of death across the gray and long-forsaken seas distressed, from east to west he passed away. Through ever night he back was borne, on black and roaring waves that ran, o'er league unlit and foundered shores that drowned before the days began, until he heard on strands of pearl, where ends the world, the music long, where ever foaming billows rolled, the yellow gold and jewels wan. He saw the mountain silent rise, where twilight lies upon the knees of Valinor and Eldamar, beheld afar beyond the seas, a wanderer escaped from night. To haven white he came at last, to elven home the green and fair, where keen the air, where pale as glass beneath the hill of Ilmarin, a glimmer in a valley sheer, the lamplit towers of Tirion are mirrored on the shadow. He tarried there from Arryn-tree, and melodies they taught to him, and sages old him marvels told, and harps of gold they brought to him. They clothed him in the elven white, and seven lights before him sent, as through the Calicurion to hidden land forlorn he went. He came into the timeless halls, where shining fall the countless years, and endless reigns the elder king in Ilmarin on mountain sheer. And words unheard were spoke then, of folk of men and elven kin, beyond the world where visions showed, forbid to those who dwell therein. A ship then new they built for him, of mithril and of elven glass, with shining prow, no shaven oar, nor sail she bore on silver mast. The Silmaril as lantern light and banner bright, with living flame to gleam thereon, by Elbereth herself was set, who thither came in wings immortal, made for him, and laid on him an undying doom, to sail the shoreless skies and come behind the sun and light of moon. From ever even's lofty hills, where softly silver fountains fall, his wings him bore a wandering light beyond the mighty mountain wall. From world's end he turned away, and yearned again to find afar his home through shadows, journeying, and burning as an island star, on high above the mists he came, a distant flame before the sun, a wonder ere the waking dawn, where gray the Norland waters run. And over Middle Earth he passed, and heard at last the weeping sore of women and of elven maids of elder days and years of yore. But on him mighty doom was laid, till moon should fade and orbit star to pass, and tarry nevermore on hither shores where mortals are. Forever still a herald on an errand that should never rest, to bear his shining lamp afar the flammifer of Westerness.
Frodo opened his eyes and saw that Bilbo was seated on his stool in a circle of listeners, who were smiling and applauding. "Now we had better have it again," said an elf. Bilbo got up and bowed. "I'm flattered, Lindir," he said, "but it would be too tiring to repeat it all." "Not too tiring for you," the elves answered, laughing. "You know you are never tired of reciting your own verses. But really, we cannot answer your question at one hearing." "What?" cried Bilbo. "You can't tell which parts were mine and which were the Dunedain's?" "It is not easy for us to tell the difference between two mortals," said the elf. "Nonsense, Lindir," snorted Bilbo. "If you can't distinguish between a man and a hobbit, your judgment is poorer than I imagined. They're as different as peas and apples." "Maybe. To sheep, other sheep no doubt appear different," laughed Lindir. "Or to shepherds. But mortals have not been our study. We have other business."
So I feel like this kind of gets back at the, you know, like how playful the elves were and childish they were in the Hobbit. This kind of gets back to it, but then it still keeps like their newfound majesty in Lord of the Rings.
Right.
You know, I feel like this is the perfect cross between it. Because it's like, you know, you're literally ribbing Bilbo here about like, "Oh, come on. We all know you like to hear yourself."
Yeah.
You know? and you know, to see, you know, he's like looking down at him like,
"Yeah, we got better business to do than worry about you folks who are immortal."
Oh, man, I love that though. Okay, so just to finish up like a couple of the details that happened for the rest of this, because then we got to talk about this place, this room, my favorite room. You know, they're trying to decide whose part was what, and so Bilbo just tells Frodo, it's like, "It was all mine." Aragorn just wanted to put in the part about some green stone. I don't even understand the importance of it otherwise, you know, but he thought it was important. And then besides that, he said, "If you want to make verses about Arendil and Elrond's house, it's your affair."
It's specifically, if you have the cheek to make verses about Arendil in the house of Elrond, that's your business.
If you want to know why that was a cheeky move on Bilbo's part, tune in, because our next special episode will be about Arendil and his whole life. Bilbo just says, "It's difficult to keep awake here until you get used to it. Not that hobbits would ever acquire quite the elvish appetite for music and poetry and tales. They seem to like them as much as food, or more. They will be going on for a long time yet. What do you say we slip off for some more quiet talk? Can we, said Frodo? Of course. This is merrymaking, not business. Come and go as you like, as long as you don't make a noise." They got up and withdrew quietly into the shadows and made for the doors. Sam they left behind, fast asleep, still with a smile on his face. In spite of his delight in Bilbo's company, Frodo felt a tug of regret as they passed out of the Hall of Fire. Even as they stopped over the threshold, a single clear voice rose in song. Albereth Githaniel, si livrinen pene miriel, o menel aglar eleneth, Nakothred Palandiriel, O Galathremin en Norath, Fenulios el Linethon, Nefayar si Nef Ayaran. Frodo halted a moment looking back. Elrond was in his chair, and the fire was on his face like a summer light upon the trees. Near him sat the Lady Arwen. To his surprise, Frodo saw that Aragorn stood beside her, his dark cloak thrown back, and he seemed to be clad in elven mail, and a star shone on his breast. They spoke together, and then suddenly it seemed to Frodo that Arwen turned towards him, and the light of her eyes fell on him from afar and pierced his heart. He stood still enchanted, while the sweet syllables of the elvish song fell like clear jewels of blended word and melody. "It is a song to Elbereth," said Bilbo. "They will sing that, and other songs of the Blessed Realm, many times tonight. Come now." He led Frodo back to his own little room. It opened onto the gardens and looked south across the ravine of Beleriand. There they sat for some while, looking through the window at the bright stars above, the steep climbing woods, and talking softly. They spoke no more of the small news of the Shire far away, nor of the dark shadows and perils that encompassed them, but of the fair things they had seen in the world together, of the elves, of the stars, of the trees, and the gentle fall of the bright year in the woods. yeah, they basically keep chatting about the Shire, and then Sam finally is like, hey, I think it's probably best we put Frodo to bed, because apparently there's this big council of Mon, he's only just gotten out. And so Bilbo says, you know, quite right, Sam, so let's get to it. And that's how the chapter ends. Now, this Hall of Fire. Dude, this thing. This? All right, well, what do you think?
Like I said, okay, so sounds to me like a mix of like a ballroom and some sort of temple meditation space or something. Like, I like the idea that it's empty most of the time, but not in the way that, you know, like a ballroom sits empty during the day all the time. Like, when there's not a wedding going on or something, it's empty. But this is much more thoughtful. Right. Like, it sounds more like the way that a chapel sits empty and people can go in there and think.
That was my thought too. This kind of sounds like it's basically a church without Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
Which that would make sense, because obviously they're not going to have Christ here yet, because this is before, this is well in the BCs, you know. But you know, like just the parts there where they always have the fire stoked and it's always burning. That kind of felt like a reference to, you have like the Blessed Sacrament out, like people have like adoration with the Blessed Sacrament sitting out there, or it's at least it's always in the tabernacle at the very least. And then also, this is kind of where you come for like vigils and like community meetings and stuff, and that kind of sounded like, you know, hymns at night sounded like the vigil prayers, basically. And then also, it's like the storytelling place, which is like you go to church to hear about the gospel, which is like the ultimate story there.
Right.
I also think it kind of felt like a church.
Yeah, and it feels like maybe a throwback to mythology as well, in that the narrative, like the oral narrative tradition, like singing songs and telling stories, is not just entertainment. Like, it's kind of the fundamental, it's both like the history and the beliefs for the in this case the elves, and like the place where that's like most manifest or whatever is where people are in touch with their gods or God or whatever, is like it's kind of all one and the same, you know. They can go there to seek counsel, to think, to celebrate, to sing, to learn, and it's all like in harmony, you know. None of those aren't different uses to them.
Right. And so then, well, we heard a couple songs there too. So it's like, in the context of it being a church, I almost kind of think like Bilbo's songs may be out of place. But then again, maybe it's kind of like the new songs that they have, like the kind of folky ones, like Lord of the Dance.
Well, it seems like Bilbo knows he's a little bit of a character and is kind of goofy hanging out with the elves, but the elves like him, so they tolerate it.
But you know, like, the elf songs, they have to be sounding like, you know, Salve Regina, like, you know, all, like, the Latin hymns, or even, or maybe even, like, the Greek, you know, Eastern hymns, you know, where it's, like, really high and lofty and, like, beautiful. And, like, you know, that elf song, like, this one, we just read through it, and it's just their elvish. Like, they didn't even, like, he didn't even attempt to translate or tell the context of it or anything.
Right.
which Tom Shippey was talking about that. He says he's got this quote. He says, Tolkien is here carrying out a rather daring exercise on his reader's patience. First, by not translating the Sindar song, and second, by explaining nothing in either case about the subject of the song, Elbereth. Which, that's why you listen to this, because we'll help you out. His belief seems to be that, for his readers, as for Frodo's hobbit companions, the sound of poetry on its own will convey some sort of meaning. Which is kind of, I mean, that's probably true. Probably right.
Yeah. It gives the implication, kind of like what we were saying, is like, if you imagine a time when people learn through songs like this, like studying the old songs is like their version of studying history. So, like, Frodo and the other hobbits used to, like, drink up Bilbo's stories when they were younger. That was them learning their old history, but also learning songs. So maybe Tolkien is kind of harping on this, like, the poetry or the songs have inherent value, just hearing them, and even if you don't know what's going on. It's like the little kids are expected to pay attention, even if they don't understand the words.
Again, too, it's just like, that song was... That was three solid pages. Like, that was, And again, so it's like, this is kind of where it's getting at, where it's like, okay, book two is going to dwarf book one. Like, I know we had the whole huge Brynn and Lúthien song in the middle of it, and then we did like a big special about it. But here it's, we're already topping that in the first chapter. Like, this is the longest song you'll find in any of these books. Mm-hmm. this was a big deal. And again, it's all these references, they just clearly add to the depth of Lord of the Rings. This whole song about Arendelle, and this one's like probably even more well crafted than the Brynn and Lúthien one, and he probably spent more time on this individual song than any of the other verses he spent on Brynn and Lúthien.
So was this song formulated in line with the story, or we just talked a little about with Brynn and Lúthien how he had, on the one hand, he's pulling it from his own life experience, and it's kind of his own love story that he's turned into a myth. But it's also something that he had composed ahead of time and then woven into the story.
He might have actually had a published lesser, you know, a published simpler version of this, and then he beefed it up and tailored it to Arendelle and tailored it for this chapter in Lord of the Rings here. But we'll actually get into the song more in the special that we're going to do, because I think we're going to have the special almost drive that, or we're going to have the song almost drive that special, but we'll see what I do, because there's a lot of stuff to cover, because Arendelle's a big character. Just like a little preview of that, Arendelle is the very first character he ever created when he started doing the mythology.
Really?
Like, this was like, he did this in 1914. Wow. Like, so it's before he even went to like the trenches, he had Arendelle in mind.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's a big deal. I think we're about done, besides that I'd say it's kind of necessary that we go through some steps in the drafting process here. And it's kind of interesting, too. But again, for people that don't care about that, this is the point where you continue. Okay, so, you know, we were saying before, like, all of book one, the big theme was that he didn't really have a direction with this story. Like, he was basically nailing the scenes, like, all the suspenseful scenes and all the iconic scenes. He was getting those pretty well, but they had no backstory whatsoever. So now, he's writing this draft, and it's basically sounding kind of like, you know, of course, it doesn't have all the details, but it's something like this, just simpler versions of all of them. And he gets it to Frodo's conversation in the middle with Gloin. In the middle of that conversation, he just stops. And then he proceeds to do an entire redraft of everything.
Okay. So it's like as though he was writing the story as soon as he started thinking about Frodo and Gloin catching up on what's been going on in the past. He was like, oh, wait a second, maybe I need to rethink that and go from the top.
I don't know if it was that individually that made him like rethink that, but at this point he's just like, okay, I think we're ready to just revise the story. I got some other major stuff that I want to add and everything. And so for this, basically we're going to go through some of the details. I had to basically skim through like 150 pages of the drafts like last night to get ready for this one. I pulled out some really broad strokes that I think were kind of important to hit on here. So at this point, when he stopped the conversation, he then had some sort of notes where he's just saying like, okay, maybe these are some major changes that I want to edit around with. And so, of course, at this point, Frodo's name is still just Bingo. Mm-hmm. But he does write down that Bingo should become Frodo. But he's still hesitant to do it because he literally has a note in the margin. He's just like, no, I'm too used to Bingo at this point. We're keeping Bingo. and then he's debating cutting out some of the hobbits and maybe only having one go with Frodo and everything. And so he's crossing out all these ideas because he's maybe going to just send one. And then all of a sudden he crosses out all of it and he just writes in the margin, Sam Gamgee, who had not existed at this point. Because at this point there were four hobbits, but the fourth hobbit was Odo. And that was basically the precursor to Fatty Bulger. And Fatty Bulger is the one that stayed behind at Crick Hollow.
Okay,
so then other interesting stuff. Idea number 12 of like just his jotting of stuff is he says that Bilbo's ring proved to be the one missing ring. All the others had come back to Mordor, but this one had been lost. Make it taken from the Lord himself when Gil-galad wrestled with him and taken by a flying elf. It was more powerful than all the other rings. But why is the Dark Lord so why did the Dark Lord desire it so? You know, like that's an open question for himself to answer. And by that, he kind of means like, what potency did this ring consist of? Like, why is it so powerful?
Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm.
So then he starts the second phase of writing. So he's going through all this stuff And so most notably for the second phase, he's reworking all the chapters. And so again, like, he's adding details that just make it approach fellowship, or he achieves sections of the fellowship, like, straight up. But most notably, he adds that second chapter, you know, like, where Frodo and Gandalf were talking, and, like, they reveal the whole history of the ring, and they find out it's a big ring.
Mm-hmm.
So that didn't exist before, and I think we mentioned that on the throughout the first book, but it's like that chapter didn't exist, which is why he had no direction whatsoever. But in that chapter, he adds in here that it's you know, obviously this was central importance for the evolution of Lord of the Rings, for it's here that they're merged in the actual narrative, the concept of the ruling ring and Sam Gamgee as the companion of Bingo / Frodo. He's still calling him Bingo. And then he writes in the margin there that Sam's going to replace Odo.
Okay.
That's
okay.
What he thinks. And then at this point, he invents the ring poem. So he's got the three rings, you know, so three for elves, dwarves get seven, you know, and like, mm-hmm. they were very successful, but they were plundered by dragons and everything. The men are like become the ring rays. Like, he's writing all this out. And then there's the last lines where Gil-galad and Orendil, you know, because it wasn't Elendil yet, and Isildur cut the ring. Isildur's killed, Gollum gets the ring. And then from there, the ring has to be destroyed in Mount Doom. So he lays out all that premise there, which we didn't already... Like, he wrote half this book, and he did not have that premise down yet, you know, but now he does, so...
When you say half this book, you mean he wrote book one.
Book one's like half of the Fellowship, and so you got halfway through the Fellowship without...
Yeah, and then it seems a little bit like, to your point earlier, that book two steps it up in terms of action and intensity and drama.
Right, because by the time we get to book two, book one will have been way more fleshed out.
But also, it's like he maybe went back, he tweaked book one to fit with his story updates, but he didn't rewrite it.
Well, hold on.
Okay. Keep going.
Well, listen to this. Yeah. Okay, so Sam emerges, and there's this element of, like, what to do with Odo, who, again, he becomes fatty. And then there's notes saying, like, well, Christopher wants to keep him, you know, because Christopher Tolkien was a kid at this point, and so it's like, ah, well, maybe we gotta keep him. Then there's the idea that Fatty's gonna stay back at Crick Hollow and wait for Gandalf. But when Gandalf comes, he's gonna go with Gandalf to Rivendell. Okay, so this is weird. Okay. All right, so keep this in mind. Okay, they get to Bombadil's house, and then he restarts again. So then he starts like a third phase. So he like updated all his chapters, you know, and then he goes back and he's gonna do like an update again. And so now, like, all the way to the first chapter again. So by this point, we're at, like, December 1938. He started writing this in late 1937, I think. So this is, like, a year's work of processing.
Okay.
At this point, this is when he adds the prologue, because there was really... The prologue, that was probably already written, but it was just in all the Hobbit chapters, but then he, like, kind of trims them down and just shoves all the crap at the beginning before the proper story starts, you know? Like, talking about how hobbits don't like to live on second floors or sleep on second floors, you know? So, nothing of significant, really, until Bree or, you know, like, there's nothing, like, no real significant changes, you know? So it's the same plan as what we've kind of been saying, or it sounds like Lord of the Rings, just assume. At Bree, he's starting to flirt with the idea that the Rangers... should be men, and they're supposed to be like the last remnants of the kings beyond the sea. But Trotter's still a hobbit, so he hasn't committed to this idea yet. You know, of course, that's the other big, you know, glaring thing when you read this, is Trotter's a hobbit, right? Then they get to Rivendell, and this is the weirdest part of all. Odo, which is Fatty Bulger, is in Rivendell with them. He actually came with Gandalf. And so now there are five hobbits in Rivendell, six hobbits, because Bilbo's there too.
Okay.
But and there's no real explanation of like Gandalf and Odo / Fatty's journey, which is weird.
Uh-huh.
But then with like, so by August 1939, then he's kind of starting to like, again, he's back to where he were at in the story and where he had gotten to in his original first drafts. And so he's getting back to his glowing story, and then he's literally writing the glowing conversation again. And then all of a sudden he thinks like, you know what? I think I should scrap the whole story, restart, and Bilbo's just going to be the hero all the way through again.
Okay.
Which is just like, no, and he's going to have Frodo and Merry be their sidekicks or something. And it's like, oh, well, you know, he still didn't... Obviously, Bilbo, the whole reason Bilbo's not the main character again is because The Hobbit ends with, like, and he lived happily ever after, you know?
Right.
And so, thankfully, he abandons that idea again. Oh, yeah. So I don't want to say about any other future ideas in case they're, like, spoilers for what's coming up. But, like, there are some, like, funny, ridiculous things. So you could read this in the... This is Return of the Shadow, Histories of Middle-earth. This is, like, the sixth one. But so in the chapter, he's still rewriting it. And so everything's similar to Lord of the Rings until you get to the part where Aragorn has to help Bilbo, you know, write the song. Because at this point, Aragorn's just Trotter, you know, and he's some stupid hobbit, you know. So Trotter comes up to Bilbo, and Bilbo's calling him, like, Perry, because I think his name is going to be, like, Peregrin Boffin or something. Like, because Pippin wasn't named Pippin yet, so that name was still available. But he's, but the shortcut, it's not Pippin, it's Perry.
Okay.
But anyways, at this point, then Tolkien writes in the margin, he's like, ?" Trotter better not be a hobbit, but a ranger. Remainder of Western men, as originally planned. So it's hard to tell what originally planned meant, but now he's starting to get the idea, like, yeah, okay, let's progress towards Aragorn. So I just wanted to go through some notes, I guess, just to, I don't know, do you have anything to say?
Mostly.
I know that was a lot, but...
Mostly, I mean, aside from the funny, like, the places where it seems the story was just, like, goofy, or the fact that they had funny names, what I was saying earlier, like, the fact that he, developed the entire larger narrative at this point, and then, I guess... is both impressive and surprising that he just, like, wings it and just, like, rolls through. It seems like, in general, that's what he's doing. Like, he, from this point on, I mean, you'll have to correct me once we can talk about drafts later on, but he then just, like, powers through the story with these new ideas in mind.
You'll have to see. I would not say power through is not the term I would use. So.
But he doesn't go back and rewrite the story from the beginning with these new concepts in mind.
He just tweaks
what he's got, and he just keeps going.
Right.
And that's a pretty interesting thing to keep in mind, that he's able to make it all, like, harmonize in spite of that.
Right. Of course. All right. So personally, I think, like, of course, the Trotter Hobbit, it's like, this is the most glaring thing that needs to be fixed. Like, I refuse this story, you know, like, until that's fixed. But then also, like, the element of, like, of the fifth Hobbit, you know,
it kind of
sounds like the fifth Beetle or something. You know? He's like some legendary character.
Right.
Like, what is this guy doing here? You know, but it's basically Fatty Bulger. So it's like, you can kind of imagine Fatty being with them on this adventure, which is weird, interesting, especially since it keeps going. Like, this will go further, but now we're caught up on the drafts. Next chapter is gonna be super busy, so we wouldn't have time to do it then. And then they're setting out, we'll return to this in a couple chapters because there are a couple interesting things that keep going. But again, like, this, hearing this guy's writing process, like you're saying, it's just like, yeah, he's winging it, you know. And it's kind of inspiring to anybody to just be like, you know, this guy, these are one of the most classic series of books ever, and you know, you can see how much writer's block he had as he went through this. So people can relate and have hope, you know, that you can get through this.
Yeah.
Hey, just an oversight on my part. Clifford and I were doing the ending to this episode last night, and I overlooked that today is March 25th when we're going to be releasing this, which is quite the day in Lord of the Rings history. Obviously, it's also quite the day in Catholic history, which Tolkien would have been aware of. This is the Feast of the Annunciation. We've just been hearing a bunch of elves singing Marian songs, basically, too. So, kind of stupid that I forgot this. You know, this is the impetus for Christmas 9 months from now. More to come on the significance of March 25th throughout this series. All right, Clifford, we're back again.
Mm-hmm.
This is you've just listened to the first episode of what I call season 3 of this podcast.
Yeah, what's season 3? Book 2?
Yeah, book 2. Okay. Cuz Hobbit was book 1, Hobbit was season 1, and then season 2 was book 1. So now book 2 would be season
3. Gotcha.
So yeah. Before I forget, maybe this will become like a corrections corner, but as I was editing through the episode, we were naming all the feasts that have happened throughout the book, and the whole point of that was just like, yeah, there are so many feasts in this book, like, it's one of those things. Just to enforce that, we actually forgot to mention one where they have a feast with Gildor and the elves in the third chapter. Like, we were trying to list them all off, and we somehow forgot that. So, I mean, just more to our point that there's so many feasts.
Yeah. Actually, in my mind, I thought that was them just passing in the woods. I forgot that they stopped to have a complete feast.
All right, Clifford, clearly you didn't listen to my recording where I
you know, brought in music to it too, and it was like the thing I was most looking forward to in all the early chapters. But okay, all right, elephant in the world, how's coronavirus going for you?
It's going okay, actually. Don't want to be too optimistic, but we're under lockdown here in San Francisco. I understand that you just joined the party.
We just went into that today on Tuesday. Yeah.
Yeah. I got to say, it seems like there's a lot of exceptions. There's still a lot of people outside.
I don't know. Well, so for me, like, it's almost not thrown off my routine at all. Mm-hmm. like I can still go to the office if I need to, even with like the shutdown. Like, I'm one of the cracks in the system. And then, well, actually, we've been like kind of doubling up episodes recently for recording stuff, mm-hmm. which makes me double busy trying to like edit it all and then getting ready for them. So, yeah, this has kept me busy to where, like, yeah, I haven't, besides that I'm hearing it in the news all the time, I haven't really noticed this thing at all.
That's fair.
Besides like social contact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But are you taking this opportunity? Will you do this with me? I've already got a week's head start, I guess, on you. Corona beards. Quarantine beards, dude. Quarantine beards.
So it's kind of funny. I was video chatting with Lyndon, my brother.
Yeah.
Who I'm fairly certain has coronavirus. he's locked in my parents' basement for quarantine, and he has a mustache now. So sure enough, he did grow a coronavirus quarantine mustache.
Yeah, well, dude, come on, you gotta do it with me. At least you gotta not shave something just to see what it'll look like. When was the last time you grew a beard?
I just get lazy sometimes, you know.
I know, because for me, the only time I would, besides this quarantine, the only time I would think it would be acceptable was on camping trips or our theoretical in the works month long bike trips.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I concur with that. Yeah.
So, you know, I think we gotta make this happen, Clifford.
Okay. Maybe I'll give it a try.
Other things about quarantine, dude. This is a fun fact. You know what Isaac Newton did while he was in quarantine?
What? Why was he quarantined?
The plagues come through all the time.
Okay.
Before modern times, plagues were kind of regular. He invented calculus.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, that's inspiration to anybody
so what, out there. What have you done today?
2-year quarantine, he invented calculus. That's it.
Okay. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think we have a review. Let me read a review, and then we can leave.
Sweet.
And then go on to the bigger matters for the night. We're doing the ending before we record whatever we're recording for the week. I know we haven't read this one. Okay, this one's funny. Juan is my spirit animal. This is from Father Mike Lawrence. Okay, I do know this guy, full disclosure. These guys know their Middle Earth. I recently read The Silmarillion for the first time and can't get enough. As a linguist, I have no idea how I hadn't crashed into Tolkien's world before. Thanks, fellas, for the show. You're brilliant. Like the Noldor.
That's good.
I also recently convinced him to read The Silmarillion, which he liked. Obviously, as you can tell from that review. Okay. Anything else for you, Clifford?
No, it's not every day we get compared to the Noldor.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, stay safe out there. Thanks everybody for listening to the episode. I think we'll be here for the night.
Yep. Thanks, y'all.
We've actually heard of Arendil. Do you remember him? We talked about him in a story before.
Is he the one who sails through the sky?
Don't spoil it! Oh. Where have we heard him before? He was in one of the other specials that we already covered.
Help me out.
Gondolin? What was he in Gondolin?
I don't remember.
All right, he was the little kid. I'm cutting this out. he was a 7-year-old kid, Clifford. Gosh.
Right. Oh, man.
All right, get ready
dropping
for that.
Dropping the ball again and again.
Oh, my gosh.